check.
Radio's working. 82 GPF, radio check.
Your radio's working.
Evidently, it's not going to spread or anything like that. Nothing to worry about.
No, well, that's good.
I'll tell you, that was an experience, Sean, when I was in Tokyo and a few of the other places, in that area. From what I've seen pictures and then being there in actuality, it's really a great experience, especially Ground Zero, where they dropped the bomb in Hiroshima.
Yeah, did they leave that Mitsubishi building up for a monument? Is that still in that area?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, from what you mentioned. I'll tell you, I was very impressed when I was in Japan. I was in China, Peking. I was expecting in China to see people running around in those sand pants in the harbor. The buildings there were amazing. These apartments, they're like 75 to 90 stories tall.
Yeah, well, they're not running around in sand pants. They've got nice hatteras yachts they're running around in Bertrams. They're no dummies.
Yeah, and also, I talked to one of the people there about, the driving regulations and everything. It's very, very stiff as far as driving in Japan or China. They have a lot of things you have to go through. And there's certain taxes that you have to pay on your vehicle. And they're very strict. They don't fool around there.
Yeah, sure. Just like this country. Morons on the road in this country than any country in the world. No, except Russia, I gotta admit. Russia has more morons on the road than we do.
I've driven in Boston, man. You can't beat the number of morons there. That's the only place I've driven all around the United States that I'm scared. Driving in L.A., New York, and all Chicago, but when you go to Boston, that is really one scary place.
Oh, yeah, going through that beltway. Oh, my God, that's worth your life doing that. If you get a chance, Google Russian car accidents or vehicle accidents. Take a look at some of those idiots. Almost everybody's got a camera in their car.
Well, you can understand why. No, I'll tell you, I had my experience of driving in California, Los Angeles. When I came to New York, I was able to blend in. But if I wouldn't have had the experience of driving in Los Angeles, I would have been devoured in New York.
I first went to L.A. That was the first time I've ever seen... they have those 12-lane areas there, just a massive highway structure. But on the entrance ramps, there was a traffic light. Traffic light told you when to use the entrance ramp. I thought that was unique.
Yeah, that was the meter, the amount of cars going in. I'll tell you one thing, if you were there near downtown L.A., and you went over that crossover, seven levels passed through. And do you remember seeing it? That was designed by a woman architect, by the way.
Yeah, it was all through their highway system over there, and some of it's scary. Well, I'll tell you, they talk about traffic here in New York. You can't compare the traffic that they have in those highways in California. Bumper to bumper and all moving at 60 miles an hour.
I know. Well, the first highway in Los Angeles was the Pasadena Freeway. And all the mistakes that were made there were the ones that they corrected. That was the first highway between L.A. and Pasadena.
Yeah, they probably had their hands full when they started that. But I was on the Coastal Highway. I don't know if that's still the same, but that had some strange areas and some weird bridges for that construct. But the view was beautiful on the whole trip.
You mean you took one all the way up from Los Angeles to San Francisco?
Yep, I took that whole ride. I did it a couple of times, and it was nice and scenic, and, did the tourist thing. It was fun.
Oh, yeah, I've done that. I'll tell you, though, it really amazed me. 4 weeks ago when I got there, when I drove up to Los Angeles back to New York, the roads are beautiful. Going through Colorado, I've done it over 17, 18 years, and I've seen the changes. And the roads between New York and Los Angeles, phenomenal roads, no less than two lanes each way, and places to stop all along the way. And I was going over 11,000 feet over the Rockies. And then we dropped back down. You ever saw the altimeter of the car go that far in the car?
Yeah, that's a good thing to have in a car. I don't have one of those. The only thing that disappoints actually as a tourist in California was I thought the beaches were rather ugly. I've been to every island in the Atlantic over here. Spent a lot of time in those islands. So when I got to California, I saw, you know, see the beaches and all. Boy, they were really terrible compared to beaches, the way you think of a beach.
I don't know. You must have not gone to Malibu or Playa del Rey. They're beautiful beaches. Malibu especially, you know, as you go further up north on the coast highway. Yeah, some of Venice is no bargain, and Santa Monica is no bargain. Beautiful up there.
Yeah, I was there. Wasn't impressed. And they're losing a lot of their beach property due to erosion. And, you know, they've been trying to solve that problem with jetties and things like that, but so far, they're battle.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, growing up on the West Coast and everything, I saw a transition, big transition. But you got to admit, you go from the beach to the mountains in about 2.5 hours, from the sun to the snow.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yep. There's a lot to see in California. You know, you can go from the southern part and see some amazing things, get up in the north, go to Sequoia Country, you know, that whole area. Oh, another thing I found out is the water is cold. I didn't enjoy that. They do have cooler water. The Pacific is not as warm as parts of the Atlantic.
Well, that's true. Well, see, I had two sites I used. I had Mount Lucas and Mount Wilson. So I'd have to run up to Lucas for the receive site and then run up to Mount Wilson for the transmit site. And sometimes I'd run both places in one day if we lost the link between them.
How's that ride up Mount Wilson? I never made that one.
It's not bad. You get up to the ranger station, and then they'll tell you if you go the rest of the way up. Because once you go beyond the ranger station on Wilson, if the weather's not good, you can wind up staying up there. Especially some of the TV stations have, you know, places to stay right at the station. And I was very familiar with CBS because my dad worked for CBS out there. But now that transmitter. But some of my transmitters were not too far from there on along the edge of the peak of Mount Wilson. We had a building we had a couple of microwave dishes that went beam the Lucas.
You got a stack of telescopes up there, too. It's tough to get at those, but yeah, I didn't know that. You could overnight up there. Sort of like that silly Mount Washington. 80 degrees on the ground when you get up there, it's 28 degrees. What a difference.
I got 2 degrees per 1,000 feet is the lapse rate. I drove Wilson many a night, and Lucas many a night. And you just got to be careful. You know, you don't go too fast. The last part of Wilson, once you pass the ranger station, it's a pretty tight road. And on Lucas, it's really tight. It's a fire road. And, you know, you get up to where the fire road starts, and they have all these locks on the gate. So you have to, you know, use the right key for your right lock to be able to unlock the gate to the fire road.
Yeah, that buddy lock system. Another thing I found out when I traveled out west when I was young and first started going out there, even like you go up Pikes Peak, there were no guardrails. There was an awful lot of areas, even the Grand Canyon, no guardrails at all. Now maybe, who knows, maybe fences and stuff, but there was some scary spots.
Yo, I see a lot of spots like that also in Europe, traveling around in Germany and a few other countries. Those roads were so small and so turny going up the hills that I can understand why you needed a small car.
Oh, yeah. In Bavaria, you go off of the, just before Austria, you go off the big highways there and you go onto those little roads. Yeah, you're right. And those people have to stay awake. That's, once you get off that Autobahn, you're on your own.
Yeah, but even the Autobahn, did you notice on the curves? There are almost, some of those curves are about 30 to 45 degrees. And, you know, that's why they can do the excessive speeds. They really hold against the road. They're curved.
Yeah, they've got a curve and they're inclined at the same time, just like some of the racetracks. And that's why those maniacs can really fly. But, you know, they've made a lot of changes over there, especially in Bavaria. There are speed limits now on it. Then you do have areas where there's absolutely no speed limit, and that's where you got to be careful. Those people are wacky.
Yeah, I'll tell you. But I was very impressed with the roads in Germany and Holland. You know, and you know, in Germany, the big thing is you must keep your car in perfect shape and physical shape. If your car has dents or something, you get fined.
Well, how about this one? I don't know if you're aware of it, but in many of the towns in Bavaria, the parking lots, the police would go into parking lots and check tire pressures and give summonses. You also had to have tire pressure right on the money. They tolerated no tolerance at all. You had to be exact with everything. Yeah, they're tough over there with cars.
Yeah, well, you know, their standards are a lot different than ours. And even, you know, I've been in some small towns around Bavaria, Germany, and everything. You know, everything is very meticulous. You know, you don't see somebody put a garbage can out and take it back.
Oh, yeah. In Augsburg, I never saw a cigarette butt on the floor. The town was spotless. You know, a lot of spots. Austria, too. Where Austria connected, spotless, beautiful, even empty lots. You may see some, you know, wildflowers, but you'll never see any debris, old cars, nothing. They're just spotless. I love it.
Well, it's a different lifestyle, John. That's a kid are complaining about, you know, boats on driveways and airplanes in driveways. They have nothing else to pick on.
Well, you know, those are the people that have no life, Hal. They have nothing to do. I am busy. We don't have time for that crap.
Funny or a funny one? I was told that my aircraft is on my property and I'm going to be charged for storage. Can you believe that? Storing my aircraft on my property and they want to charge me for storage if I don't pay an extremely high fine for each day.
That will be interesting in court. Your property and they collect the storage fee. That doesn't sound right to me for some reason.
John, it didn't sound right to me either because I asked him, you also get a storage fee for all the boats that are on the grass and everything? And I was told, oh no, the boats are different than an airplane. So I said, how's there a difference? The boat has, if it's on a trailer, it has a tires, it has a propeller, and it has a motor. My plane has tires, propeller, and motor. What the hell is the difference?
Well, the boat people call the propeller a wheel, believe it or not. They don't call them propellers.
But still, theoretically, it is a propeller. It has blades. It goes through, instead of air, it goes through, you know, liquid. But it is a propeller.
Oh, absolutely. And it propels the boat. I agree with you 100%, but they prefer to call them wheels. I would be talking to these guys that have these big boats, and, oh, I put a new set of wheels on today. And I'm thinking to myself, you must be talking about the trailer. No, you put on two propellers. Silly stuff.
I'll tell you, this whole thing about the plane, the judges would not give a violation for it. They can't get a judge that will sign on.
Well, that's Pontius Pilate. You know, they're washing their hands of it. You're not going to get me involved in this one. So, they don't make a decision. No foul. That's all.
John, it's going to get very interesting. I'll tell you more over the phone. You're not going to believe what's going on.
Well, we'll see what happens. All right, let me get back to my paperwork. Talk to you soon. KC2WGB.
KC2WGB, KC2WGB. I got to take care of some stuff, too. I just played hooky here a minute, that's all. KC2WGB, keep six dirty purple zombies. Signing clear.
KC2WGB clear.
Come across this old microphone from a radio I really like. and I really like this microphone. So I put it on my new Kenwood, and sure enough, it seems to be working great.
It's working fine. By the way, my name is Rich. Romeo, India, Charlie, okay, I'm a nice of people park on the border of Nassau and Suffolk.
Well, okay, Rich, yeah, we've worked before, a long time ago. I remember you and where you're from and all of that. Name here is Peter. Well, it's November 2, Yankee Alpha Victor, and I'm out in Ronkonkoma.
Okay, Blondie, yeah. Hey, coming in on the east. I don't remember you, but I'm very flattered that you remember me. Not too far from Hamity, Bill. You know where that is?
Yeah, I do. I used to work out in Lindenhurst, so I know your neck of the woods. Went out there quite a bit some time ago when I worked out that way. And I get out that way every now and again, you know, and so I know your neighborhood. I know, you know where you are.
Very good, Peter. I'm just starting to learn the neighborhood. I've been here about 3 years with Patricia. Don't drive anymore. Hold on, got a phone call. N2EO, stand by.
Okay, N2YAV, I'll stand by for a bit, but I'm in the middle of a lot of stuff, so if you're not back by the time I come back, it's been great talking. N2YAV.
Somebody rang the phone 2 times, hung up, no problem.
Hey, I'm listening to the courtesy tones here, and I think that when I stop transmitting, I hear 1 beep, and when you stop transmitting, I hear 2, but I'm not sure. Let's see what happens when I stop transmitting. How many beeps are there?
That's because you're on the eastern link. I'm on the western link, that's why.
Okay, I'm going to have to clear out. I hear a breaking station, but I got to clear out, get some stuff done. I really thank you for the test. Hand it to the breaking station, and unfortunately, I remember talking to him so many times, I can't remember his name. Over to the breaking station, and the YAV is out.
Okay, Peter, I don't hear him in there. You said, yeah. I'm just going to be listening. Take will be on with the YMON TechNet in about 6 minutes. And 2EO Grant.
And 2GDN.
Okay, I hear N2TDN. N2TDN. You're acknowledged, and I have to go though. But you are getting in. N2YAV is clear.
N2HVR. I hear you, go right ahead. That's making sure that my radio's working. N2HVR. N2TDN, Miller Place.
Alpha Romeo, Romeo Echo November.
Hey, very good there, Warren. We've got Joey over here. We're located over here in Miller Place there.
Okay, flying business. I'm going to stand down. You got a pretty big net coming on in about a minute.
Hey, very good. All right, I'll be standing by. I'm going to pick up.
Net. Tonight at 8 o'clock, welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Next time.
Looks like the clock is set about 30 seconds fast. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. I try to act as net control for the technical net. And you guys have heard it a zillion times, but there's always a few people who find the technical net, join it for the first time, and they want to know, what is it? And we give them a little bit of an introduction at the beginning. It is a gathering of people who are interested in wireless equipment, radio equipment, and want to know how it works, how to make it work better. I have to tell you guys that the whole science of radio is a bit complicated, and to get full understanding of it, takes some time. Schools do a less than mediocre job, in my opinion, of teaching at least the antenna portion of radio science. They do a medium good job of teaching transmitters and receivers in some cases, but the antenna portion leaves a lot to be desired. And so people who are curious and people who really make progress in almost any field are the ones that are curious. The curious radio operators gather here, and we share information. John, KC2WGB, me, Paul, WS2N, and also Hal, K60BZ, that group of four guys have our individual areas of expertise, but we don't know everything. Thank goodness, let me drop it. Thank goodness somebody will come along quite often saying, hey, I've got some experience in that area, and to give us the benefit of that experience. Not everything here is going to be non-repetitive. I mean, you don't have to listen to very many tech nets, and you say, gee, you guys are always doing standing wave ratio. Well, there's an awful lot to standing wave ratio, and there's a lot of misunderstandings out there. So you got to hear it from two or three different angles before it sort of starts making sense. Not everything you hear is going to be 100% accurate, but it's kind of a peer-reviewed material. For the last 10 years of tech nets are all recorded by a very enthusiastic guy named Mike KC2NJI, and he's got a website where you can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can listen to the last 10 years of TechNet. Many thousands of hours of this stuff there by going to the website www.amateurradio.tangovictor, amateurradio.tangovictor, and you can listen to all of those past TechNets. Let me drop it. Some guys have got to go to work the next day. They can't stay for the whole 4 hours. Typically starts at 8 o'clock, typically ends at midnight. And at my request, they turn the machine off at midnight because some of us have got to go to work the next day. Got to stop somewhere. There have been a couple of occasions when it went to the wee hours of the morning. That does show you the kind of enthusiasm that's built up from time to time. The first hour is general questions and answers where people sign in if they have a question or a comment. They give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. If you're just listening, you need not sign in to indicate that. The TechNet has been around since 1982. That's 34 and a fraction years, if I get the math right, and go September of 1982. After 34 years of TechNet, essentially every single Sunday night, 52 of them per year, by now we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. So a long list of people signing and saying they're listening, that's not required. I also, there's another crazy question a lot of people ask on various nets, is there anybody with emergency traffic? They ask that question at the beginning of every net. There never is, but you don't have to tell people that if there is an emergency, they're allowed to break in. When you do give an answer or making a transmission, try to remember to first give a delay, listen for the four beeps. Now, drop. Now this machine is interconnected by way of EchoLink and IRLP, and without the delay of the four beeps, that whole system doesn't get reset correctly. There are people who sign in from time to time in other states, other countries, quite far out of the area. And so they get locked out if you don't listen for the four beeps. Typical sign-in would sound, well, before I give you that, the first hour is general questions. Then it's followed by John, KC2WGB, who collects the mailbag submittals. People who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the right equipment to talk to us directly, they send some kind of a communication, snail mail, and that Pigeon droppings. They sent something to John, KC2WGB, and he collects a few of those. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. And tonight he'll be giving us SpaceNet number 163 of the series. And after that, we get into deeper subjects with whatever time that's left over. You'll notice that there isn't strict regimentation of the TechNet. The first section is about an hour under normal conditions. If we get into some hot and heavy subject and everybody's really excited, and it goes beyond the first hour and it goes into 2 hours, big deal. We do it. There are people who say, gee, you guys are not there. You're not regulated. You're not regimented. Yeah? I'm telling you that ahead of time. Okay, let's see. A typical sign-in would sound like this. N2HVR. Nick and yes. That would be a typical sign-in. So give me your call letters if you've got a question or a comment for the net. Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW in the second net. We're listening.
And here we go. Rich and yes with a nice comment.
Okay, Rich recognized. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now.
Comments about my 80 meter dipole.
Very fine, Paul. Okay. We're listening to your, waiting for your comments on your 80 meter dipole. I wonder if we have KE2EJ on frequency tonight, because there seems to be a mysterious signal that that he has to accommodate, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, I wonder if you're there, Eric. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm here, Dick. Give me a couple minutes to get to where I'm going, and I will take care of things for you.
Okay, I thank you, Eric. It's obvious there is a need tonight. Somebody is pretty rambunctious. Alrighty, anyone else assigned into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW listening.
Beach Warrior White, show yes.
Okay, we've got you, Joe. Thank you. So far, we've got a sign in to Rich, Paul, and Joe. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW. Listening as soon as this noise suppresses. And as soon as I let up, then give me your sign-in.
Helpful to me, an old call was W-A-2-B-I-T. We call it Wabbit. And, Barry's coming over here tomorrow to put up an antenna for me in Massapequa Park. I lost my right leg last 2 years ago to diabetes, an amputee, and he's very, very helpful to me. I'm very proud to know Barry. Went into the Army, went to Vietnam, made him a lieutenant. They wanted him to re-up. He opted to stay out. And he came back to the U.S. And home. I don't have too much more to add, but he's a very, very good friend. And the end of
time.
Back to
Ned, N2EO. Yeah, Barry into Mike Bravo, or W2BIT, has been in the ham radio for a zillion years. I was with him last night. We got together at 10 in the morning, 10 o'clock at night, and I think we separated like 1:30 in the morning, having an interesting discussion on a number of subjects. There was one time when I visited him at, I think, midnight, and at 1 o'clock in the morning, he and I climbed the tower. He wanted to show me a particular antenna he was building, and from the top of his, I think it was like 80-foot tower, we're looking at the buildings in New York City at nighttime with all of their lights. Beautiful scene. As you can tell, Barry and I don't necessarily live by the clock. Sometimes we do things at funny hours, and he's done an awful lot of moonbounds on 2 meters, mostly, an awful lot of it on two, some of it with a great big 160-element collinear array, some of it with his 28-foot dish that he had for a while, and it's kind of amazing how much you can do on a very small piece of land in Far Rockaway, as long as you have the cooperation of your neighbors, and his neighbors agree with him quite a bit. Interesting character. So if you ever get a chance to see him face-to-face, he's quite a quite a specimen, about 155 pounds, about 6 foot tall, runs about 3 miles a day, a bit of a health nut, as well as quite a ham radio operator. Alrighty, the next person who signed in was Paul, WS2N, and Paul, what have you done with an 80-meter dipole? And quite often I use an 80-meter dipole, let me drop. I use an 80-meter dipole quite frequently in order to transmit information in order to convey a certain antenna concept that is not very well coupled, very well conveyed in the books, the lectures, or whatever. And what I'm talking about is the typical guy builds an 80-meter dipole at a 14-gauge household copper wire, which is a little, tiny bit more than a 16th of an inch in diameter. So this whole 132-foot long half-wave dipole on, say, 3750 megahertz, 3750 kilohertz, casts a shadow on the ground of about 1 square foot, 132 feet long, 1/16 of an inch wide. You go through the mathematics, it's in the vicinity of 1 square foot. But because it resonates on that 80-meter band, the magic of resonance and what goes on with the signals bouncing around in that antenna, that simple ordinary dipole presents an effective radio area of more than 8,500 square feet, as long as the signal is on the right frequency with, let's say, horizontal polarization. You calculate the amount of energy that antenna collects in the receive mode, and you'll reconfirm 8,500 square feet of effective radio area. Let me drop. You carefully measure the pattern of that antenna. You will again confirm that it is an elliptical-shaped object in space, something in the vicinity of 150 feet major dimension, something like 80 or 60 feet in the minor dimension of the ellipse of its effective capture area. You measure that pattern in three-dimensional space, you'll be reconfirming that area. How in the world can that simple piece of wire do that? And even if that 80-meter dipole is directly behind the Con Ed wiring that's at the exact same altitude, directly across the street from you, directly in the direction of the guy you want to talk to in London, we'll say, you would think that Con Ed wiring is going to cast a shadow on your antenna and stop it working. Because that Con Ed wiring is not resonant 99% of the time. It casts an area of a couple of square feet as a shadow onto your 8,500 square feet. You do a careful measurement of whether or not the Con Ed wiring is there or not there, and you'll see almost no difference. You'd be amazed how many guys think that, well, they'll never be able to work in that direction because of the power wiring. As long as that power wiring is not making a whole lot of arcing noise, it's not giving you much grief because it's not resonant. The magic of resonance and effective areas, as you can see, there's a lot of peculiar things going on here that are very beneficial once you understand it. So let's see what Paul's doing with his 80-meter dipole. And because, let me drop.
TDN, what a question.
Yeah, you're going to, we're going to take your question, Mr. I think it's TDN, Tango Delta November is what it sounds like. You'll correct me in a minute. Because Paul is a space enthusiast from way back, his particular 80-meter dipole doesn't have 8,500 square feet of area. That's got 8,550 square feet of area. Because he's done it a little bit better. I'm having some fun with Paul. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Antenna that I put back up actually a couple of months ago. But I really haven't used it that much. Propagation's pretty much down. But, you know, it fell down during that, the winter time with the ice that we had, the winds, you know, the ice just never stopped. And that was 40, and that was 1987. I mean, it came down a lot of times because of the rope, you know, or whatever I had holding it would sometimes break. But the wire itself never broke. It was 12-gauge wire. And this time, finally, the wire gave out. It was solid. It wasn't stranded. I was stranded up there. So, in those days, I just soldered the two ends. No ballon. Let me drop it. Which was, you know, a bit annoying. Let's say you had, you know, the antenna come down. I'd roll up the 12-gauge wire and put it up, you know, leaning up against the chimney, and it might stay there for a week or two until I put it back up again. But I could never disconnect it because I didn't have a PL-259 on it. So this time I decided to do it right because I'm going to replace the whole wire. And I did it with, I always said I got to put stranded wire up there. I did it with, like you said, 14-gauge stranded wire. Left the insulation on, screen, can't even see it in the trees. Not that it matters by me. You've seen the place, Dick. Nobody says anything here. What I did is instead of putting a ballon up, you know, buying a ballon, I went with the poor man's ballon. I wanted to see how that would work, that you've talked about many times. So I took RG58, six turns, about 8 inches in diameter, and just a tie wrap attached to the eyes of the made a homemade connector, you know, out of PVC, you know, with stainless steel eyes, and also, you know, two eyes sticking out of there, and you know, that's how the connections are made, with little spade connectors, these stainless steel nuts. So the two eyes are there, and I attached the homemade ballon to that. I thought that would be a good way to go. And that's up there. Hopefully I'll stay there for a couple of more decades. But I just want to report on that. Signal-wise, I really don't know as much difference. I don't have an SWR except for what's, you know, a meter except for what's on the Kenwood 440. And it shows good. You know, I made it 134 feet. I'm going to favor the CW portion of the band deck. Let me try it back to you.
Sounds like you're getting a lot of good service out of that antenna. And I think I saw that 80-meter dipole in your backyard. And you were in the, when I first met you, you were in your lounge chair in your backyard in the summertime, as I remember. Yeah, exactly 1 year ago. And you were under that dipole. My guess is you've sometimes done some operating from the backyard, either by remotely controlling the equipment or moving the equipment itself into the backyard. And from what I remember, I think your 80-meter dipole looked to me like it was in the vicinity of 30 feet in the air,
where a tree is the support on one end. Is that approximately at the pole, WS2N, KQLIW?
Everything's up on trees. Got a G5 off the junior up there for the other bands. They're on two separate trees, and this one, the 80 meter, is on two different trees. Yeah, it's probably 25 feet. That's, you know, but one side is a hill, so I gained on the other side about 12 feet. But I guess I could call it a sloping dipole if I wanted to. I'd like to support it from the middle, but there's nothing really up there to do that properly. Unless I, you know, run a message or cable or something. But it seems to be okay the way it is. And it works great, and I know we talked about it, so I wanted to report to you about it. I like the idea of putting the PL-259 on there. I should have done that years ago. But what I was amazed was the copper wire. It's solid. It was actually giving me some intermittency for, I'd say, a couple of months on the radio as it was mostly transmitting some, you know, I'd get some kind of comments. So I think that was breaking intermittently. And then finally, it went all the way. So it's hard to believe that the solid copper wire would eventually break, you know, with all the winds, but, you know, over decades, it does happen. I think I would always go with the stranded wire. You know, we say, yeah, stranded wire is the way to go for any kind of movement. I wonder if you agree with that. Back to you, Dick.
One of the things that's kind of hard for us to accept is that on a windy day, using a tree as a support, the amount of motion of that tree is way beyond what common sense would lead you to believe. As that tree sways back and forth, your wire is being tugged on, and it goes from slack to super taut, so to speak, periodically. And solid wire like copper, or solid wire made out of aluminum, or aluminum sheet material, for instance, of those three materials that I just described, all have a fatigue limit. In other words, no matter how small the deflection is, you deflect that material periodically, cyclically, you'll eventually get crystallization and failure. And how much you can bend an object in the case of sheet metal is a big function of how thick it is. In the case of wire that's solid, it's a big function of what is its diameter. Stranded wire, because the individual strands can be bent at a much tighter angle before you start getting crystallization, you can tolerate a hell of a lot more cyclic bending with stranded wire as opposed to solid wire. Radio-wise, there's very little difference, particularly at 80 meters, of those two materials. Let me drop it. And if you had the option, let me think now, half-inch width, when you make the dipole itself out of materials that are very large in width, very large in diameter, let's say, as a function of wavelength. I mean, a typical guy builds an 80-meter dipole out of 14-gauge or 12-gauge wire in your case, which is between 16th and 3/32 of an inch diameter, approximately. The actual ratio of diameter to length, we're talking about 3 or 5,000 to 1. That's an extremely high ratio of length to diameter. And therefore, when you look at the right curves that are in Chapter 4, the very issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and you can also get it by way of that article that I've written called The Perfect Impedance Match of a Dipole, if you could make it, let me pick a number, 10 feet in diameter, you would get a lot more bandwidth. Well, a 10-foot diameter dipole on 80 meters, even if you built it as a birdcage, it would be a significant construction. When you're building the dipole at 915 megacycles, as I was doing professionally over the last 10 years, making the sheet metal of the dipole a half inch wide when the dipole is 4 1/2 inches long, very easy to do. And so on 80 meters, that would be equivalent to something like 10 or 15 feet in diameter. You get a lot more bandwidth, a lot more control of standing wave ratio, all kinds of good things happen. One of the things that you mentioned I'm going to address, let me drop it, is that whenever we look at the diagrams of an 80-meter dipole, of a dipole in general, any of the books on the question and answer, whatever, it's usually shown
as a straight up piece of wire, flat parallel to the ground, with a transmission line in the center. And because you see that diagram so often, you think that's the only way to make a high quality dipole on any of our ham radio bands. Absolutely not true. If you make one end higher than the other, so that it's slanted, you worry about polarization. If you set it up purely vertical, you've got a tree that's tall enough, as K2KEY did. Mel had a tree out in front of his property that was tall enough. They could set up the dipole vertically. And he got some beautiful performance out of that. And you would worry about, I'm talking to a guy in London. He's using a vertical antenna, and I'm using a horizontal antenna. We're not going to hear each other. You can easily hear people say things like that. That's absolutely not true. Let me drop. The way that signal gets to London is to make a number of bounces off of that ionosphere, bounces between ionosphere and ground, probably a couple of times between Long Island and London, we'll say, or Long Island and in Tokyo, if that's where you're talking to a guy. And that ionosphere is a plasma. It is a, in other words, it is air molecules up high being bombarded with ultraviolet radiation so that ionization takes place. In other words, some of those electrons are removed from some of those nucleuses of some of those air molecule atoms, or molecules, yes, and as such, it is a plasma. Whenever you mix plasma with magnetic field, have a phenomenon called Faraday rotation. Michael Faraday is one of the first guys to recognize this, so it's given his name. The bottom line of all this is that 80-meter signal, each time it goes through that ionosphere, doesn't stay constant in polarization. It twists some number of times, which changes from day to day. On this particular day, your horizontal dipole bounces off the ionosphere, and by the time the signal gets to your buddy in London, it's vertically polarized. Today, tomorrow it might be slant 45 to the right, and the next day slant 45 to the left. The ionosphere is continuously changing its characteristics, but it's rotating that signal. So polarization becomes a little bit spooky, so to speak, and it's a factor that's not often recognized. Also, if the dipole has, let me drop it. If it has a raised center, because your best support on your property is in the center, and your outer supports are down low, now it's an inverted V. And people worry about, what about the performance when you do that? What about the polarization? And there's some huge advantages you get out of an inverted V. When you look at it broadside, it still gives you a nearly perfect horizontal polarized signal. When you look at it in view, ordinary dipole that's out flat has a pretty deep null off the end. You set up your dipole so that it's north-south, try to favor east-west signal, so to speak. And if you look at the pattern north and south, it's got a pretty deep null if it is an ordinary flat-out dipole. When it's inverted V, you've got a significant amount of signal off of those ends. The signal off the ends is vertically polarized. The signal off the broadside directions is horizontally polarized. In between is some kind of a mixture. So slanting the dipole in funny ways, making the center higher or lower than the outer tips, putting loading coils on it, top hat capacitors, zigzagging it, bending the ends down or up because you don't have property that's long enough. You have the freedom of doing a tremendous number of things to that dipole that'll look different than the books, and it'll still give you 95% of the performance. Let me drop. In some cases, it's going to give you 130% of the performance. The null that you would normally get off the ends, you don't get that with an inverted V dipole. So, and feeding it in the center is the conventional way of doing it. You don't have to feed it in the center. You've got the right kind of a balancing structure. You can feed it center, 10%, 50%, 90% off to one side. You can feed the outer end. If you want to set up that vertical dipole as one solid piece of wire with no center insulator, you set it, you hang it vertically from your evergreen tree out in front of your property, like Mel did, K2KEY, who's now a silent key, and you feed it from the bottom, feed the outer edge. It gives you beautiful performance if you know what you're doing. The only thing that changes is that when you feed the outer edge, you're not feeding the 70 ohm impedance that you get in the center. You get something like 1,500 ohms of impedance at the outer edge. And with one simple L network and one inductor and one capacitor, you can convert your 50-ohm transmission line, your 50-ohm transmitter, up to 1,500 ohms. It's simple. And so
don't negate the, don't throw that in the trash of good ideas, if you know what I mean. Feeding the outer edge in some cases is a beautiful thing to do. So stranded wire is going to give you a lot more survivability of the flexing. Let me drop. And if you were using RG8 cable as the way of feeding your dipole and you were making a poor man's balance, there's nothing magic about the particular diameter of the multiple turns that you make as an RF choke near the dipole. The average guy with RG8 would make that more like a foot diameter for those turns. And when you study the inductance formula that's in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, you find out that the amount of inductance you get goes up by square law as you increase the diameter. The same number of turns gives you more inductance. The whole reason you're making those turns is to act as an RF choke for the signal that wants to flow down the outside of the coax cable. You're choking it off with a whole lot of series inductance by that poor man's balance. The signal that flows down the center, between the center conductor and the outer shield, inner side of it, it doesn't know, that signal doesn't know it's going through a coil. It thinks it's just going down a straight piece of coax, and at the end it meets the dipole and does its thing. So there's an amazing number of things that you can do with a dipole that you think are bad, and they're not. But putting up the right kinds of springs and pulleys and weights and whatever to accommodate the fact that your tree is going to sway on a windy day, and if that's your support for the dipole, you've got to figure on that one. And here I am giving you guys a talk on this subject. And in the past, I remember putting in bigger and bigger springs on my dipole that went over to a tree. Let me drop.
Can I make a comment real fast? Because I'm not going to stay too long. K6DP3.
Go ahead, Hal.
This is about dipoles. The only thing I wanted to say, it seems like all discussions have to do with antennas and SWR. The comment I want to make, if people want to bring up other subjects of circuitry, oscillators, power supplies, I'm a wealth of knowledge. And if people ask questions, I will give answers, and we can spread input. You know, Dick, the only thing people want to listen to is about antennas. That's all I have to say. K6DPZ.
This questioner was asking about an antenna, and we have a second questioner that's also asking about antenna. So we're discussing antennas this time, Hal. And yeah, maybe I'm going a little bit too deep into it, but there's a lot of misunderstanding here that I think should be covered. So all I'm saying is that that poor man's balun, making it larger in diameter, has some advantages. Because you use RG58, 6-inch diameter for that poor man's balun, is a very convenient size for you. Had you fed it with RG8, you could have used it as a larger coil if you wanted to. And there's a lot of freedom along these lines. Maybe I've approached some of the things that you wanted to hear about, Paul. And right after I send it back to you for a final, I'll then go over to Mr. TDN. WS2N, the man who asked about an 80-meter dipole. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Paul.
Can I make one more comment before I get out of here?
If you do it briefly, go right ahead.
How do you find out from a lot of people who are listening to the TechNet that maybe they want to get a little broader subject matter, only the antennas? That's my comment. If some people could throw in their comments, I would be very interested. K6DPC clear.
Okay. Hal has just brought up a fairly strongly felt opinion. His opinion seems to be that I, in particular, who I love antennas so much, that I discuss antennas too much. You guys have been listening for the last 34 years. You've got some opinions. As I come around to you on each of your questions tonight, please tell us, if you think there's too darn much antennas and we should throw out all this antenna talk, express yourself on that subject. This guy who's going to express himself on that one is Paul, WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
There's your comment. Let me pick it up. Well, first of all, thanks for the answer on the... I figured the stranded is really the way to go, but because it was 14 gauge as opposed to the 12 gauge solid, I don't know. Maybe it was. I'm still going to go with the stranded wire. I think that's got to be better. Well, whatever, it's up there and it's going to stay there until the cows come home. The most important thing to me is not as much where to feed it. All right, if you feed it at the end, you have to set it up, and make sure that network is right, but. To me, any kind of a long dipole up.